Maybe we can never know too much about the Holocaust. The idea of Hitler's Germany willfully exterminating 6 million Jews is still one that challenges the human mind. But it happened, and one of today's guests survived it. Michael Grunbaum is the survivor. He and Todd Hazak-Lowy are the co-authors of a book that tells Michael's story to young readers. It's called Somewhere There Is Still a Son. Michael Grunbaum was 9 years old when World War II started. 3 years later, he and his family were sent to the Theresien concentration camp, also known as Theresienstadt, for the duration of the war. He moved to the United States in 1950 and prospered in college, the army, and work. He and late wife Thelma wrote an earlier book about the child survivors of Theresien. Todd Hazak-Lowy is an author with several books to his credit, including his young adult debut novel, Me Being Me Is Exactly as Insane as You Being You. Todd, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you here today. Michael, are you here as well?
I am there, yes.
Right. Uh-huh. Great to have you both here. Todd, why don't you start, and you can tell us how this collaboration came about.
Yeah, well, I had written a middle grade novel called 33 Minutes that Aladdin, an imprint of Simon & Schuster, had published, and this was the publisher that acquired Michael's story, and they approached me thinking that perhaps I could take this on since that book, the 33 Minutes, was a book narrated by a young boy, even though it was a young boy living kind of in contemporary United States. I also have a background in Jewish studies. I used to be a professor of Hebrew literature, so they thought that I would be able to handle the all the historical material. So that was how I came onto the project.
Well, the idea of acquiring your story, Michael Grunbaum, makes it sound like there was a bit of a torturous road to get to this book.
Well, yeah, actually it started out as a children's story, and I wrote a story where I had a bear narrate the one particular reason why we survived. It was a stuffed teddy bear that saved us. And unfortunately, you know, I tried to get somebody interested in publishing it for about 2.5 years, and I got absolutely nowhere. But then suddenly I got a phone call from the editor of Aladdin Books, who said that, well, she suggested that if I were interested in dropping the idea of a children's book, they would send somebody, a professional writer, to Boston and interview me, not just about that one episode, but about my whole life during the Second World War. And so that's what happened, and that's how that came into the picture.
Are you saying much new in this book that that had not been said in your earlier book with Thelma?
I think so. I think many more details in that book. I was actually fairly reluctant to talk about my experience when Thelma was writing her book. And she interviewed about 10 of the survivors that lived with me. And I was the last one that she interviewed because I was so reluctant to do it. But I finally did it, but it was only sort of a few pages long. And this one here is a whole book, and it's very well written. Todd, I think, did an excellent job. And it's written for young adults. You might say the same age that I was in when I experienced all these things.
Well, that was the other question, Todd, was that when you talk about middle grade, what age level are we talking about here?
Yeah, so middle grade, there's a little bit of variation on that. 8 to 12 was my previous book. This book is being marketed to 10 and 14 or 10 and up. So it's kind of the age range right below young adult, though there's a little bit of overlap in those categories. So, but I would say that the book is very much for the age that Michael is in the book, which is, you know, 9 to 14 or, you know, 9 to 15.
Yeah, really is talking to his own age group there. How tricky is the writing, Todd, of such a book to adequately convey the horrors to younger readers, but not to overdo them?
Well, when I was writing this, I was really working on a couple of hunches. A lot of them seem to have been good hunches, but at the time, you're just sort of following your sense of what might work. And the big decision I made was that he would narrate it in present tense. And what that allowed was for me to sort of avoid a lot of what I call sort of the discourse on the Holocaust that we now have, and which is valuable in its way. And, you know, Michael didn't know he was in the middle of something that would eventually be called the Holocaust. The word doesn't appear in the book. And so what I was trying to do was just to sort of describe things that were sort of in front of his face for the most part. As to the other part of the question, what I would say is that one of the, I think, the valuable things about Michael's story is that, as horrible as it was in all sorts of ways, within the sort of larger constellation of the Holocaust, he was fortunate enough to miss some of the worst of the worst of the worst. And so I think that's something that allows readers to fully engage with it without being utterly overwhelmed. But there are some things near the end of the book that I think allow the reader to contextualize Michael's experience. And also, just to be really clear, you know, there are really, really difficult and tough moments that are narrated in the book and are narrated somewhat graphically or at least directly.
Michael, you begin an hour time with your mother's album. What was in it?
Well, my mother, she was a collector of documents and letters and coupons and tickets and things like that. And when we were liberated, she made a little album out of it. And she kept that album. We brought it to the United States, and she kept it until she passed away in 1974. And then I inherited that album. And when I was approaching the age of 80, I thought to myself, I better do something with this album. So I donated it to the Holocaust Museum in Washington.
All right, we'll pick it up on the other side of a break there. We're talking with Michael Gruenbaum and Todd Hazak-Lowy about the book Somewhere There Is Still a Son, a memoir of the Holocaust, aimed at middle grade readers. We're talking 10 to 14 years old. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with our guests and with you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today about a book about the Holocaust for younger readers. We're talking 10 years old and up. That is the target audience of the memoir, Somewhere There Is Still a Son. It is primarily telling the tale of Michael Gruenbaum, who was living in Prague as World War II started at the age of 9. Ended up in the Terezin concentration camp with his mother and sister, survived the experience, and now writes about it with the help of Todd Hazak-Lowy, who is a published author in his own right several times over and a former professor of Hebrew literature. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Michael, you were telling the story of your mother's album and the donation to the Holocaust Museum.
Right.
And
what happened was, I called the curator at the Holocaust Museum, and she came to my house, and she couldn't believe her luck, because these days all they get is one letter or one document, but here there was a whole collection of documents, and she was so thrilled about it, she took it back to Washington and showed it to the entire board at the Holocaust Museum, and they were all thrilled about it. And so I got caught in that excitement, and that's when I started writing that children's book.
And for Todd, had you worked on any project quite like this before?
Not at all, no. Nothing even close to it. And I never thought I would. The only reason I agreed to it at the time was that it was an opportunity to work with my editor, Lisa Abrams, who's the woman who edited my previous two books and who I love working with. So I thought it would be a good idea to say yes to her and the publisher.
And, you know, Michael had mentioned being interviewed for the book. Was it several interviews? Was it one very long one?
What happened was I went out to Boston for a couple days, and we met and talked, and I tried to record some things he said, and he gave me a bunch of materials. What really wound up happening was that once I started writing it in earnest, I would email Michael very, very regularly, sometimes multiple times a day, and I eventually got the impression that Michael was sleeping next to his computer because his turnaround time was always quite quick. And so the truth is at the time when I first interviewed him, I didn't know really what to ask beyond the obvious, and it wasn't until I was in the middle of writing that I knew the kind of questions that I truly needed answers to.
So, Michael, the opening scene from Prague, when you were 8 years old, there's a sense of the adults always talking about Germany and Nazis. They had not moved into Prague yet, but what was the knowledge you had about the Germans and the Nazis from your parents and other adults?
Well, to be honest with you, as a child, I was very protected by my parents. I mean, they carried that burden by themselves, and they didn't discuss it with us too much. So I was allowed to be a child, and that carried through into Terezin as well, because there, instead of my mother protecting me, it was this guy, this fellow that was in charge of us by the name of Franta, who protected us. And he himself really didn't know what was going on, because the worst part about being in Terezin were these transports to the east, and nobody knew what the east meant. All we knew is that nobody ever had come back from there. So that was the story. So we, as children, we were protected. The people that were in charge of us tried very hard to keep us as children and not to have to worry about the future. And so that's really what was happening.
But, you know, there's a vignette in there where the Nazis do come marching in, and you you knew what the salute was. You know, the standard Nazi arm out salute on an angle, but you said you knew you'd get in trouble if your parents caught you doing it. So you must have known something about the general acceptance in your community of the Nazis.
Well, I think in general it was bad news. I mean, actually, the bad news was multiplied when I was looking out the window and I see a couple standing on the roof of a building across from me, jumping to their death. So obviously, that was not good news. So that sort of tipped me off that things were going to get worse and worse.
Yeah, that's an amazing scene, because you got these soldiers marching in, all goose-stepping into town, doing the Nazi salute occasionally, and this couple jumping off the roof of a building across the street to commit suicide,
right.
which comes back to you, Todd Hazak-Lowy. I mean, I guess I think in terms of trying to protect younger readers, but given the stuff that you can see pretty easily on TV or the Internet these days, maybe I'm thinking in terms of too much protection, but this is conveyed in such a way to be not overly bloody or gross or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think a little goes a long way, and I think also the experience of reading is a different kind of intimate experience, and if you, you know, give them something direct and real, you know, that I think the reader will really connect with it, and I think the other part of the book that I think is powerful for readers, actually young and old, is that, you know, they're, because Michael, as a narrator, and not just a character, doesn't really understand fully what's happening, the reader is sort of compelled to try to figure things out along with him. And I think the instance of this couple jumping from that building is a good example of that, because he certainly doesn't understand what he's seeing other than the actual visual. He doesn't understand why this couple would do this, and it's actually something that, you know, appears a number of times later in the book of him, you know, some, in a sort of roundabout way, beginning to realize retrospectively why they may have done that.
Well, you know, it's well conveyed, because the Michael narrating the book, you know, says, particularly of the suicide, maybe I just imagined I saw that, or I just saw it wrong or something, which is very childlike. And I wonder how you as a writer stay in that voice.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess to the extent that I have any talent, that's what it is. I maybe it's arrested development, but I apparently am good at thinking as a child. So, you know, that's why they brought me on board. But it also was, you know, there was something about for me as somebody, you know, I have a PhD in Jewish studies, and I've thought long and hard about the Holocaust for 30 plus years, and for me, the real power of writing this book was the exercise of trying to think like a young Michael was an exercise in trying to see all this again for the first time and to see it for what it was. And it was, I guess I was naive to think I could take on this project and not have it be a very powerful emotional experience for me. But being Michael for the better part of 6 months was quite potent.
So, Michael, let's talk about the kinds of changes that happened in your life immediately after the Nazis moved in. What happened?
Well, what happened was that we had a large apartment in Prague. My father was a well-known attorney. My mother was sort of a socialite. We had a cook. We had a governess. We had artwork and books and oriental rugs, and we even had a car. Hardly anybody had a car in those days. My father parked it in a garage 2 blocks away from where we lived and used it only on the weekends to visit his parents, who lived about 2 hours away. And then sometimes we made an excursion, but that was it. So when the Germans came, all that changed. We had to abandon the apartment. We were told to move into the downtown Prague area, where there was where they established sort of a ghetto, and we moved into a very small apartment. And then we were told to wear a yellow star, so we had to put that on all our outer clothing. And of course, what happened there was that if I went outside, there would be a band of kids chasing me and pelting me with stones. So that was not very nice. But we were not allowed to attend any school. We were not allowed to play in the parks or go to concerts or go to movies. We had to sit in the back of streetcars. We were not allowed to travel outside Prague. We had to turn in all the jewelry and artwork, radios, skis, bicycles, musical instruments, and so on. All our bank accounts were confiscated. My parents were not allowed to work. And we couldn't associate with any non-Jewish friends. So as far as the groceries are concerned, we were allowed to shop only a certain days and certain hours, and we were allowed or disallowed to buy certain goods like apples and things like that. We were not allowed to do that. So as I recited all these edicts that are just now, you can get a pretty good idea that life was not very pleasant.
Not at all. We were talking about life in Czechoslovakia as the Germans moved in and began to segregate the Jews and send them off to camps. Michael Gruenbaum was right in the middle of that at the tender age of 9. And Todd Hazak-Lowy is his co-author on Somewhere There Is Still a Sun, a memoir of the Holocaust written for younger readers. 10 and up is basically the age range of the book. You know, I had to wonder, as you went through the list in the book, what Jews were allowed to buy. What did you eat?
It was, they were not allowed very much, that's for sure. Just the minimum, really, just to exist, because they knew damn well that eventually we would be deported, and so you didn't acquire anything, because first of all, the money was running out, and second of all, there was no space to put it in. So it was a pretty bad existence in those days. So for that reason, I say in the book that, in a way, I was fairly anxious to get out of there. And it's sort of funny to say, but I was pleased to be finally getting a summons to go to somewhere else. I didn't know where that somewhere else was, but it turned out to be this camp called Terezin, and that's where we were sent in November of 1942.
So Prague had gotten so bad that you just wanted to be out of it.
Right. In fact, I didn't mention this, but, you know, my father was on a business trip in London, and he decided to come back because he wanted to be with his parents and his own family. And so he was in Prague. He couldn't work anymore. They wouldn't let him work. And one day the Gestapo came and took him away, and within 2 months they killed him. So that was another experience we had to go through.
It's a very jarring part of the book, and couldn't be anything but that. And just in terms of the pacing of the book, Todd Hazak-Lowy, there's a bit of time skipping early in the book. Give us an idea to the approach here. I mean, this could have been a very, very long book, and it's quite readable at 300 something pages. But you know, the level of detail is something you probably had to wrestle with in just mapping out the approach.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that happened even before I started writing it in earnest was I just put together a timeline that was based both on things Michael had told me, but also things from the historical record. And there were certain dates that it was very clear that there would be a chapter about them. So the date where the Nazis enter Prague, that was clearly going to be a chapter. And then there were other chapters that were more to be representative of a certain point that they were at and the deterioration of life for them in Prague. And one of the things that was interesting about writing the book was that I assumed that once I got to the end, I would have to go back and tie the chapters together and sort of add various plot elements. And somehow, when I got to the end and read it and had my wife read it and other people, they just said, I think you're pretty much done. And so, you know, I think it was a case in which there was enough sort of clues scattered around here and there that a reader can read it and fill in the gaps of what's happened, say, in the 6 months that have passed in between chapters.
That makes sense, because what you're getting is to turning points chapter by chapter rather than just a daily slog through, you know, gee, we had soup again for dinner, that sort of thing. I mean,
exactly.
You know, that could have gone on for a long time. You do have a sister, Marietta, in the book that we haven't talked about yet. I mean, in the midst of all that was happening around you, were you able to function as normal kids do, in the sense of you bickered with each other a lot, Michael?
Right. Yeah. I mean, my sister was 4 years older, and she was a girl. She was not interested in some of the things that I was interested in, like sports. But what we enjoyed most about my father not being able to work was that he was able to spend time with us. And so we used to play card games. There's a card game called Mariage. We used to play almost every day. And I used to play chess with my father and things like that. And we used to go for walks together. So that was the plus side of the terrible thing that happened, which is that my father was unable to work. And so that was, I would say, probably the only time that I really played with my sister by playing with my father as well.
You had already told us about the night the officers came to get your father. In the book, you know, the SS officers with the lightning stripe S's on their collars and everything, and which was scary enough just to look at. Did you have a sense of real doom once those people came for your father?
Say that again.
Did you have a real sense of doom once those people came for your father?
I would say that, yeah. Uh-huh. It certainly was not a good sign, that's for sure. But I was hoping that it wouldn't have the ending that it had.
Which was your father's funeral, which is conveyed in the book as well. I mean, tell us what you were thinking about just the problems of being Jewish in that place at that time.
Well, it was, I've just recited to you all the different edicts that came through almost daily. You know, things like when my father and I were walking and we saw our cook on the other side of the street, and she was looking away because she didn't want to be associated with us. Think like that, you know, and that's a very good example of how people should behave. You know?
So the summoning, it sounds like this had already gone through the ghetto where the Jews were moved in Prague, the summoning to Terezin, or Theresienstadt, as some people know it. What word, had any word come back about what to expect from going there?
No, I mean, Terezin was not an extermination camp. It was a transition camp. And so there were about 140,000 Jewish people that came to Terezin. About 90,000 of those were eventually deported and sent to Auschwitz. And most of them ended up in gas chambers as they arrived in Auschwitz. There were about 35,000 people that died in Terezin, mostly elderly people who died of malnutrition and disease. And so there were only a handful of maybe 15,000 or so that were left in Terezin, and I was one of the lucky ones that survived.
When you were getting ready to go to Terezin, what were the instructions to you for what to take, what to leave behind, those sorts of things?
Oh, well, you were allowed, I think, 50 kilos per person. Of course, you couldn't carry that by yourself, but that's all you could. So most of the possessions that we had that time were either left in the apartment or, you know, under the cover of darkness. My mother used to go and try to save some of our possessions by loaning them, you might say, to some of my old friends, Czech friends. But when we came back 6 years later, they somehow couldn't remember that they ever got those things, or they just simply were surprised that we came back, and so somehow we got very little back when we returned to Prague.
Michael Grunbaum, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a survivor of the Terezin concentration camp during World War II. Todd Hazak-Lowy helped them write the book, Somewhere There Is Still a Sun. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break. 800-838-3760 by phone. jx@jeffnet.org by email. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Michael and Todd and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the Holocaust as reflected in the eyes of a child, because Michael Grunbaum was a child in Prague as World War II got started. He was 9 years old when the war started. 3 years later, he and his mother and sister went to the Terezin concentration camp, Theresienstadt in the German, and waited for something to happen. They did survive the war, the three of them. Michael is the listed principal author of the book Somewhere There Is Still a Sun, about his experiences. The book is pitched to younger audiences. Todd Hazak-Lowy did the work of writing the book. He has written many books of his own, and he's a professor of Hebrew literature formerly. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. You might have questions or comments about this period in history or Michael and Todd's telling of it. And you can also join us by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So, Michael, you were just telling us about your mother giving some valuables to people in Prague and hoping that she could get them back at the end of the war. I've been struck all through. You mentioned the fact that you know, non-Jews pretended not to know you. That whole level of alienness is one that I think may be the hardest thing to comprehend, is that people who you knew and liked and worked with pretended they had nothing to do with you.
Well, I know what it is. It was the fear. If anybody was caught helping the Jewish people, or, for instance, if there were some shops that were owned by the Jews, we really didn't want to be seen going to those shops and buying anything there. So the one thing about the totalitarian regime is that people are very afraid that their neighbors would squeal on them. And so you get into a situation where you don't say anything. You have to be very careful not to be observed associating with people that you are not supposed to be associating with, and things like that. So that's very hard to understand, but that's what happens.
For Todd, you've known this story about the Holocaust obviously for all your life, but I just wonder if learning it on such a personal level and then trying to convey it to kids creates some issues of its own.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Part of it was to realize that the Michael story is its own unique kind of collection of details, and in some ways it. You know, when I first read Michael's story, Michael, I don't know if I've ever even told you this, I thought, well, his story, it's not that unusual or that different. But there was something about sort of normalcy of Michael as a child, sort of a very typical boy, and what he went through that allowed me, if I just was true to that, that I thought the piece would have its own power. The effort here wasn't to communicate the horror of the entire giant historical event. It was to be true to Michael's slice of it.
We have a couple of emails here, starting with Mike in Medford, who writes, "Thank you for sharing your experience. My great-grandparents fled Russia and Poland during the pogroms. It can often be hard to understand the experience of past generations. The recent wave of anti-Semitism in Europe has been a real awakening. Having lived in France, history doesn't seem too far away now. What do you think of this increasing anti-Semitism? Is it at all similar to your experience as a youth?" That from Mike in Medford. Michael Grunbaum, would you take that first?
Well, I'm very afraid of that. That is very true. I think in France, there's a lot of anti-Semitism, and so the interesting thing is that there isn't that much now in Germany, except, you know, there are certain groups, of course, that do that. But in general, there are some countries in Europe that where anti-Semitism is very much alive. And I can understand what this gentleman was talking about, the pogroms. That's certainly a horrible experience.
Todd, what do you make of the current climate in the world?
You know, I think xenophobia in general is a huge problem, and there's obviously a lot of problems in Europe right now that stem from the fact that cultures that haven't lived together as much in the past are now together with each other. And for whatever reason, anti-Semitism is always a useful tool for various people, but this is, you know, something that's inseparable from a lot of other issues, some of which are actually about Islam and the way that Muslims are accepted or not accepted in Europe as well. So I don't pretend to be an expert on that, but it's a problem. It's definitely a problem.
Another call here from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Grunbaum and Todd Hazak-Lowy.
Hi, thanks. So, not being Jewish, but supporting, what do you think of finding the rest of the Nazi war criminals? Is that a concern? Was that a thing that many people like you? Because if I were you, man, I'd want to hunt down the last one of them and find them somewhere, even if they're 100 years old. That's kind of my question, is what's your approach to, you know, like Simon Wiesenthal, who was just determined. That'd be me. Thanks.
Mm. All right. Thanks, John. Appreciate that. Michael, your thoughts?
Okay. I think I know what the question was. I think he's absolutely right that they should be hunted to the very last man. There's a very good book by a Harvard professor called Hitler's Willing Executioners, and it points out the fact that it wasn't just a bunch of hoodlums around Hitler that caused this whole problem, but it was pretty much most of the German citizenry was in cahoots with that, and so they should definitely be punished, no question.
An email from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. He writes, my paternal grandfather, a decorated World War I hero, was among those who died in Theresienstadt. My maternal grandmother survived. Others ended up in Dachau, and a few, like my father and granduncle, survived hiding out in the mountains. My mother survived by cheer guts, a.k.a. chutzpah. Still and forever an unspeakable familiar memory. Was there not a general sense of this can't be true, or this is just a temporary transitional thing? Does not the human mind protect itself this way? How was that for you, Michael? Asks Wolfgang in Sunny Valley.
Well, we lived day by day. That's really what it was. You never knew what the next day would bring. And the only thing I could say is that sometime in the spring of 1945, we saw a bunch of airplanes come by and fly over us, and we realized these were American airplanes and that the end of the war must be coming up very soon. And that was our big hope. And we were finally liberated on the 8th of May by the Russian Red Army. And needless to say, that was a very joyful day, except that just before then, some of the prisoners were coming back from the death marches, and they were sending them to Theresienstadt. And they brought along an epidemic of typhoid. And so nobody could leave Theresienstadt until the end of May, because they had to do something about that. So it was sort of a mixed situation, but we were definitely hoping that the war was going to end. And like I said, Terezin was a transition camp. In the fall of 1944, the Germans decided that they would somehow get rid of two-thirds of the inmates in Terezin, and they sent them all in 11 transports to the east, to Auschwitz. And so once we survived that, we could breathe easier until the following spring, when finally we were liberated.
What saved you? How were the decisions made about who got on those transports and who stayed behind?
Well, there was people that had the duty of preparing lists of people that were going to be getting the summons to appear in the assembly area to board the trains. And in my case, it's just a certain very strange situation because we were already in the assembly area. The lucky thing was that we had a high number, 1,350. And that was out of a group of people of 1,500. So my mother had enough time to run over to the arts department where she was working, and she told her boss, look, we just got an order from the SS man to make some teddy bears, stuffed teddy bears for his children for Christmas. And this order will not be filled. You got to tell him that. Because I'm being deported, and I was the one that she said I was the one that was working on it. So he finally, when he caught the, luckily the SS man was nearby, he caught him and told him, and the SS man thought about it for a while, and he said, okay, pull her out. And then her boss says, yeah, but, you know, she has two children, and if they go, she will go with them. So he said, okay, pull them out as well, but nobody else. And that's the reason why I'm here today.
Because the commandant needed teddy bears for his kids, and your mom
exactly.
Didn't go, wow. That's...
Can I add one small thing?
Please.
Is that, as Michael mentioned much earlier in the interview, his mother had the foresight to save some of the documents and papers that came her way, and the order taking them off this transport is included in the book, and it's striking because it looks not much more than a small little typed out note that is, I don't know, how big is it, Michael? A third of a sheet of paper, if that?
Yeah, very small, yeah.
You know, and it saved three people's lives.
That's an incredible story. And there are many pictures in the book, I should point out, too, to help illustrate things in a section of plates toward the middle of it all. I haven't asked Michael about your impressions when you first got to Terezin, what you saw there and what it became clear the structure of daily life would be like.
Well, it was a big shock because the first thing that happened was that I was separated from my mother. I mean, that's a shock to any child. And so the minute I arrived, I was assigned into this one room in the school building where we were housed. And, the fellow that was in charge of us was only about 8 years older than we were. And I was living with 40 other boys in that one room. And so that was a very different life than what I was experiencing before. So I saw my mother occasionally, but the fellow that was in charge of our room made sure that there was no interference from any of the parents because he was in control and he was responsible. And so, my mother and he sometimes were at odds about what should be done. But in general, he just didn't want to really talk to the parents. So that's really what happened.
I'm reminded of Peter Pan and the Lost Boys. I mean, it seems like you really were sort of a society unto yourselves.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. It was different. You know, we had to work during the day. I was, at the beginning, I was working in the garden outside the fortress. But then later on, I was working in the bakery. I was a horse distributing rolls and things like that from the bakery to the distribution centers. And that, in a way, was a little better job because once in a while, I was able to snitch a hello that fell off the wagon. And so that helped me greatly.
It sounds like quite a, I mean, I hate to think of it as of good coming out of this, but, you know, the fact is you did bond with the people there. And judging by some of the accounts in the book, that you kept in touch with some of the people you called the Nesserim brothers.
Well, what happened was that there were about 10 or 12 survivors from our room. And after the communists were overthrown in 1989, we had our first reunion of everybody. Now, you got to understand, most everybody emigrated from Czechoslovakia. So some people went to Australia, some people went to Brazil. There were several people that stayed in different countries in Europe. One person went to Canada, and some people were in the United States. So all of us got together and had a reunion in Prague in 1992. And from that point on, we had a reunion every 5 years or so. And we had the last one in 2008. In Los Angeles, because our leader, the fellow that was in charge of us, was celebrating his 90th birthday, and he was willing to travel much anymore. So, but he was amazing because he, after the war, especially after the communists were taken over, he kept calling everybody once every 2 weeks to try to find out what was new in their lives. So he was one of the unusual people that kept the interest up. And that was very good in keeping us all together.
Todd Hazzacalohi, the book's been out a couple of months now. I wonder what the responses have been like.
The responses have been really great, I would say uniformly so. I actually did my first two school visits here in suburban Chicago on Friday to over 300 eighth graders and around 100 fifth graders at two different schools, and they seem really, really interested in it. They responded really strongly and have a great deal of interest in this material. And as I said before, also, I think adults have found the book surprisingly strong as well, and I think has something to do with the immediacy of the narration that allows people to sort of see these events again for the first time.
It's a very fresh and clear voice and a very well-told story. Somewhere There Is Still a Sun, Michael Gruenbaum lived it. Todd Hazzacalohi wrote it. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much
for having us.